Broadcasting on 103.2, this is Dublin City FM. And all that is now, and all that is gone, and all that's to come, and everything under the sun is in view, but the sun is eclipsed by the moon.
Hello. Yes, hello and welcome to the Astronomy Show here on 103.2 Dublin City FM with John Dixon and myself, Ben Emmett. Good evening, John.
And a very good evening to you, Ben, and hi, everyone.
As ever, our email address is astronomy@dublincityfm.ie and the text and WhatsApp number is 087-179-1032. That's 087-179-1032. And you can also catch us live on the internet at dublincityfm.ie or has a podcast, lots to get through as usual, and as usual, we'll start with what to see in the in the night sky. Now that astronomical night is back.
Yes, when did that happen? Just in the last few days?
Yes.
6-12-18 rule, huh? Yeah, 6 degrees, 12 degrees, oh, and 18 degrees for all the different...
We're talking about the degrees of twilight. We'll get to that in a moment, yes.
Mercury first on the list, hiding deep in the sunrise at the moment, so you're not really going to see that. Venus, it's dimmed a little bit, minus 4.0 dead, and it was minus 4.1 last week. It rises above the east-northeast horizon about an hour just before the first sign of dawn. And just after that, Jupiter follows. I'll go into that just in a moment. And still quite bright. It's the brightest that we have is Venus at the moment, minus 4.0. Jupiter, on the other hand, the second brightest planet at magnitude, minus 1.9. You will get to see it. Saturday morning, August the 9th, which is just coming up shortly. They're going to rise about 10 minutes apart, so a separation of only 3 degrees, because they're pretty close. And they are going to come a little bit closer at 0.9 of a degree apart on August the 12th, with Jupiter then to Venus's upper left, so just keep an eye out for that one as well. Mars, a weak magnitude plus 1.6, it's on the border of Leo, and Virgo still glimmers very low due west in twilight. Binoculars will, of course, help. And Mars sets at twilight's end, so you're not really a great chance to see that. So we're going to have to wait for another couple of months or so before we get to see Mars again, I suppose, in some sort of an evening sky. Saturn, plus 0.8. It's in Pisces at the moment. It rises at 10 p.m. And the best time to try a telescope with Saturn is the hours just before dawn, and the wings, or the Saturn's rings, should I say, are edge-on, just about almost edge-on this year. I'm not mad keen on the edge-on ones. I prefer the ones that go up to about, was it, about 23 degrees or something thereabouts. But it's always nice to see Saturn's rings, definitely. And the rings and their shadow form a super thin black line along Saturn's equator. That's the only other good thing about those. So you will see a black line if you have a telescope or a good pair of binoculars to point in Saturn's direction. Uranus, plus 5.8. Really hard to see. It's near Pleiades at the moment. And Neptune is 7.9, so it's a really, really difficult one to see. And you are going to need a telescope to see that as well. So really the one to watch for, minus 4, is Venus. It's a good sight because I'm up quite often, quite early, just before... You know that sort of bright light just before dawn, where you can see up straight in the head, up in the air. It's really dark, and then it just goes, you can see the light appearing. But it's changing at the moment, and the times for sunrise and sunset are a little bit different, nearly weekly now at this stage.
Yes, and the twilight times are shortening rapidly, especially nautical twilight, or astronomical twilight, I should say. We'll get to that now after we just mentioned the 87% waxing moon, which will rise very shortly now. In fact, about from our location here in Dublin, that's only about 5 minutes from rising in the east, and it will be due south at its highest at 10:37 p.m. this evening, and it will set just after 1:30 tomorrow morning. And when it rises tomorrow evening at 8:22 p.m., it will be up to 93% waxing gibbous phase as we head towards the full moon, which is a sturgeon moon, a green corn moon, a grain moon, or a red moon, depending on your background, or depending what country you are from, or your ethnic, I suppose, origin. Anyway, the full moon will be on Saturday the 9th. Getting to the sun now, which will rise tomorrow morning in Dublin. That's Wednesday the 6th of August at 5:50 a.m., which is 12 minutes later than a week ago, local noon, when the sun is at its highest, and due south is at 1:30 p.m., and then the sun sets 9:10 p.m.
Yeah.
Which is a whole 13 minutes earlier than a week ago. Then we'll have civil twilight until 9:52 p.m., then nautical twilight until 10:48 p.m., which is 20 minutes earlier than a week ago, and then astronomical twilight will end and nighttime will begin just after midnight tomorrow evening, which is 48 minutes earlier than a week ago. So... And a week, you know, I think it was only for a few minutes or so, we did actually have astronomical night. But now we have astronomical night back again. And so if you're a deep sky observer, that's good news for you, because you will now be able to see the, or at least better able to see the very dim objects, nebula and galaxies. So that means there will be 25 minutes less daylight than a week ago tomorrow, another 3 minutes and 35 seconds less daylight than today, when there'll be 15 hours and 21 minutes between sunrise and sunset.
Yeah, I mentioned something just before we came on air. I said, why do stars twinkle? And your answer was, they don't.
They don't.
No. Well, they don't, really. But
they appear to.
Yeah, I suppose, you remember the nursery rhyme, Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star?
And you're a little fella.
Yeah, everybody remembers that. It's not just a rhyme. It's a scientific fact, and all you have to do is look up at the sky at night, and you will see that it's true. So, you will see hundreds of stars in the sky twinkling and gleaming, but as you look up into the vast night sky, you will notice that not everything twinkles. This points us in a different direction. And these are, in fact, planets. So, why do stars twinkle and planets don't? Well, they don't. It's all to do with atmospherics.
So, the lower down in your local sky that a star is, the more atmosphere you're looking through before, or the more atmosphere the starlight has to come through before it gets to you, unlike if it was directly overhead. And it's basically all the swirling about and different temperature gradients in the atmosphere and such like.
Even on a very calm day, it doesn't affect it at all. It's just the way it comes into us. And I suppose it's like looking in a swimming pool through the water, and something looks different at off angle. There's a sort of a prismatic effect.
Yeah, when you look in the bottom of the swimming pool and the tiles and the grouting, and it seems to wobble back and forth and move. But we know that the tiles and the grouting isn't moving. It's the light mostly defracted as it comes through the water towards the surface.
Yep, as I say, a gentle breeze doesn't make any difference. There will be movement and turbulence in the 100 kilometres between the Earth and space on the Kármán line in, and that's why stars twinkle. Just atmospherics making them twinkle, but planets are a little bit closer, a little bit bigger. Well, when I say a little bit bigger, they're a lot closer. They look bigger, but they're not, and they don't twinkle, they just sit there as well. Did want to mention the Perseid meteor shower peaking this year on the 12th of August, which is not far away, one of my favourite ones to watch. And unfortunately, the moon rises about 10:06 p.m., so it's not really great, but it's okay. So almost a full moon at that stage. This will brighten the sky dramatically, meaning the rural sky watchers will have the skies as bright as those who live in towns and cities. So it's not really going to affect, I suppose it affects it all, really. And it's a shame. It just happens that way, unfortunately. So just remember that. We'll get to see a few up to that. Where will be the 9th? It's something now, is it? The 5th?
Where will be the 5th?
5th, yeah. We normally have a sort of a about a week or so before, a week or so afterwards, and the 12th into the 13th is the peak of them. So you can see probably about 120 per hour.
That's in a perfectly dark sky.
Yeah, but where we are, of course, in the countryside, perfectly dark, well, at 88 to 90 degrees above our heads. Yeah, so there we go. Put that in the diary as well.
Even darker than our locations. Yes. Shall we move on?
Yes, we shall. And I wanted to. I did want to mention the time for the spot, the red spot on Jupiter, but we're not really going to get a chance to see that in any details. I don't even mention it at the moment. Word was that Spain has offered €400 million to revive a 30-meter telescope, as somebody over on the other side of the water suggests cancelling the whole project. So, just last Wednesday, 23rd, Diana Morant, the Minister of Science, Innovation and Universities in Spain, announced the Spanish government will offer €400 million to save the 30-metre telescope. It's a massive astronomy observation facility facing possible cancellations due to budget restraints in the US. So Spain once and can be the home of the future astronomy and astrophysics, according to the press release just in the last week or so. And originally, the 30-metre telescope was planned to adorn a mountain in Hawaii called very hard to pronounce those words, Mauna Kea. That sounds about right, doesn't it? I can stand corrected on that one, definitely. This is a very, very popular viewing point because it's so high into the sky and it's striking dark skies that it gets, and the great weather tends to help as well. That'd be marvellous, wouldn't it? We don't have mountains that high.
Not here in...
Nope. Thousand
Little Green Ireland.
Yeah, there you go. Still not bad, though. That's the thing. So it looks like they're going to donate or help to revive the 30-metre telescope. So that's a brilliant one. What does that one do? That's the big question. Is it an it's a big optical telescope, I think. There could be a few more things under the roof as well. Nothing more to say about it. I must look that one up and just see if we can add to it.
Okay. Thank you, John, for that. Now, President Trump, God bless him. It's his aura in everywhere. Anyway, there's been much said about his so-called big, beautiful bill, but apparently hidden in there is a plan to relocate the Space Shuttle Discovery from a museum, which is currently outside Washington, down to Houston. But the legalities of it are fairly uncertain, with the Smithsonian Institution saying that Congress has no authority to give away what it considers private property. And this is even before you look at the logistical and financial challenges of it. They said the Smithsonian Institution owns the discovery and holds it in trust, for the American public. And, of course, the museum receives substantial federal funding. And they said in 2012, NASA transferred all rights, title, interest, and ownership of the shuttle to the Smithsonian. And, of course, a discovery is one of their main centerpieces to the place where it is kept, and attracts a few million visitors every year. And in there was allocated in that bill $85 million for the move, though a non-partisan congressional research service had projected a far higher cost of around $325 million, adding that the NASA administrator's power over non-NASA entities is very unclear. You may recall, of course, that the Space Shuttle program ended in 2011 after a 30-year run, which carried American astronauts after the Apollo era. This shuttle discovery was the most flown shuttle, and apparently there was not a lot of support within Houston to want the shuttle. They have the one down there. It is more a prototype. I was on it myself, and it's on the back of one of the big 747s that they used to, especially modified 747s that they used to transport the shuttle when it landed in anywhere other than back at Cape Canaveral. When it landed at Edwards Air Force Base in California, they had to attach it to the top of this specially modified Boeing 747 and transport it across the country. But apparently, those NASA had two of those 747s to ferry retired shuttles. One is now a museum piece. I think that's the one in that I saw down in Houston, Texas. And the other is out of service. And they say that leaves land on water transport, but the nearest water entrance to the Potomac River is about 30 miles away, but it may be too shallow for the orbiter and require a barge, requiring a 100-mile journey instead. And the water transport would require a big, massive, enclosed barge. And they've only one such vessel. It's owned by the military, and they reckon there's a few problems with logistically and legally about loaning it to a civilian agency. And a solicitor with a certain attorney's office over there said that he didn't think the Secretary Duffy or anyone in the federal government has any more authority to order the move of the Discovery than you or I do, he said. And he said the government could invoke eminent domain, which is seizing private property for public use, but it would have to pay a fair market value. Of course, Smithsonian, said they say they own it, and Congress has no power to take it off them. On the other hand, they get a lot of federal funding, and you know what happens generally when Mr. Trump doesn't, things don't go his way. He likes to cut funding to people he's had a row with.
Now, talking about the US and India launch a powerful Earth monitoring satellite. This was July the 30th, which was last week. It's a formidable new radio satellite jointly developed by the US and India. It was launched last Wednesday. It's designed to track subtle changes in Earth's land and ice surfaces and help predict both natural and human-caused hazards. So that'll be an interesting one to see as well. So dubbed NISAR. The NASA ISRO, or the Synthetic Aperture Radar, it's picking up a truck-sized one this time, not just a bus spacecraft, which blasted off around 5:40 p.m. US time, which is 12:10 GMT, from the Satish Jawan Space Center in India's southeastern coast. And that's interesting to see what goes on. It's an interesting looking satellite as well. It's got peculiar wings and nearly like an umbrella on the top of it to see. So India in the space race as well. And just NASA is also readying for the crewed Artemis 2 moon flight. Now, this time seems like it'll never ever come around. It's they've planned it for next April 2026. It's going to be a 10-day mission. That will send a crew of four around the moon to prepare for future crewed moon landings. I can't wait for this, to be honest.
Artemis 3.
Yeah, or Artemis, whatever it is before it gets there. But let's hope, fingers crossed, that next April they will go for their 10-day mission. And it's easy to follow on the internet, Artemis 2. And it shows you the trajectory when it takes off, goes around the Earth a few times, goes out a little bit further, then swings and does a figure of eight. And then comes back home again. So that'll be brilliant, but it'll be great.
They'll go further than any other astronauts, including further away from the Earth than any other astronauts, including the Apollo astronauts who were in low lunar orbit when they got to the moon. But this one is going to be in a big very eccentric orbit. So they will have flown when it comes around. Will have been further away from the Earth than any other people. Mission commanders Reid Weissman, pilot Victor Glover, and mission specialists Christina Koch and Jeremy Hansen. And Jeremy Hansen is actually from the Canadian Space Agency, and the other three are from NASA. So that's looking forward to that. And be the first Canadian to get as far as the moon. And then, of course, Artemis 3, which is planned for 2027 sometime, maybe September, I think it'll be later in the year, will be the first planned to land on the moon.
It just seems like eternity, something to go back to anywhere outside other than the ISS.
Yeah, there's Well, we've been waiting on this. I mean, we've been reporting on this for many years now. In fact, I remember saying some years ago, they won't land on the moon until 2024, which, of course, has been and gone. And we haven't even had Artemis 2 yet. But speaking of going to the moon and even further to Mars, of course, you have to take most of the things you require with you, including water. Water is relatively heavy and you can't just... It doesn't rain up there. So you got to recycle it. So, and there are recycling little plants and equipment on the space station, of course. And apparently they recover over between 90 and 98% of the water used up there in space. And it includes the water that they recover comes from several sources, including moisture in the cabin air, hygiene, like brushing your teeth, and actually sweat and urine.
Mm-hmm.
So
lovely.
And the water is the wastewater is much more concentrated than earth-based wastewater that we flush away here. But the water recovery systems do employ the same type of principles as we use here on Earth. But with regard to recovering the water from sweat and urine, I'll give you a little detail now about the urine processor. They said it can recover 75% of the water from urine by heating and vacuum compression. The recovery water is sent to the water processor assembly for further treatment, and the remaining liquid called brine still contains a significant amount of water. So NASA developed a brine processor to extract the final fraction of water from this urine brine, and in that brine processor assembly, warm, dry air evaporates water from leftover brine. A filter separates the contaminants from the water vapor, and the water vapor is collected to become drinking water. And they reckon they will recover in a very impressive 98% of the water, and that the water processes assembly treatment, basically that the quality of the water that they get out the end is, in fact, often cleaner than many a municipal water supply here on Earth.
It's hard to believe, really, isn't it?
Yeah, well, they do. Well, water is supposed to be recycled here. If you think of, you remember all that primary school geography you did about the clouds and the heating and the evaporation of water and the formation of clouds and the condensing and the rain and that goes into the reservoirs and is purified and pumped to our houses and then we drink it and flush it down the loo and out it goes again to sea and,
it's amazing
the cycle continues. They just did this much quicker and more efficiently.
Yeah, when it evaporates off the sea, it doesn't pick the salt or anything with it. It's really strange. Yeah.
Ah, chemistry, my boy. Chemistry.
Yeah, well, that's your area.
Well, the salt is... it's got to do with a lot of things, but boiling point and melting points of water and salts are much different.
More reading for me, I'm afraid.
We won't go into that now today.
We had a launch last Friday. Yes. August the 1st, I did watch this.
Oh.
I just happened to stumble across it. It's been very, I won't say quiet, because it was cancelled for a little while. It was postponed a little bit. And anyway, it took off at 15:43 GMT, which is 3:45 our time on Friday. And that was a day later than originally planned. And SpaceX tried to launch the mission on Thursday the 31st. But unfortunately, it wasn't really technical. It was only bad weather, so that wasn't too bad. So they all got up there. Quite a number of them up there at the moment. There must be almost 11 people up there, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Some of those are coming down back soon. So it'll be back to probably about 6 or 7, I think. I'm not sure on the actual amount. Okay. So the Crew 11, as it was called, sent Zena Cardman, Mike Finke, along with Yui, and the cosmonaut Oleg Platonov to the ISS for 6 whole months. See, there's a thing. That'd be something. Looking down at the planet through the...
See, when the doc, they spoke to the astronauts already on board to say... Well, we have cold drinks and hot food and hugs waiting.
And hugs, yeah. Oh, there's a huge...
You see them when they come through the hatch and they're all hugging and laughing.
I can imagine, because when you get onto an aeroplane after somebody's been on it onto the next flight, there's an air. And they say that there's a particular air when you get into the space station that's unique. and the door opens and go, oh.
The smell.
Yeah.
The odor. Yeah,
whatever. But you get used to it very fast. Yeah. So.
Oh, yeah. Well, there's six already on board. So many we got? We had
four went up, yeah.
Four and six is ten, I believe.
Yeah, okay. It was not ten. Okay. Not like you stowing away on Discovery.
Yeah. Hmm. Already on board are JAXA's, which is the Japanese Space Agency's, Takuya Onishi, commander of the current Expedition 73 mission, Anne McLean and Nicole Ayers of NASA, and cosmonaut Kirill Peskov, Sergei Ryzakov and Alexei Zubritsky. So, and some of them, as you mentioned, are coming back shortly. Oh, that crew that went up today, or recently that you mentioned, it's the first space flight for Cardman and Platonov, and the second for Yuri. And you won't be surprised to hear, because we're familiar with the name, all right, with Finky, Mike Fink. Mm-hmm. Yes, heard of him before. Mm-hmm. This is his fourth time being blasted off.
Yeah,
into
must be
space.
Must be doing some good. I think it's, as we spoke about earlier, reaction time and reflexes, and able to adjust to minor situations or major situations, I suppose. So you and I wouldn't. Well, I certainly wouldn't anyway. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And just a little bit of history for you. On this day, well, I won't say on this day, but July the 15th, which is a couple of weeks ago, 1975, astronauts and cosmonauts launched on the first joint US-Soviet space mission. Yeah, and it was the marking of the end of the space race, I suppose, because America had been to the moon, etc., and all that sort of stuff. So we're 1975, July the 15th, just remember that date, and I think it's great to see.
Thank you, John. I see that the head of Russia's space agency, that's Roscosmos, they said that they had recently agreed with NASA during talks in the United States to extend the International Space Station's operation until 2028. This is not really news. We have heard this one before. One of these areas where the US and Russia still have some cooperation. And they said, that is Roscosmos, said that its chief, Dmitry Bakunov, arrived in the United States for talks with NASA's acting administrator, Sean Duffy. Apparently it was their first such meeting since 2018. They said the dialogue went well. We'll operate the ISS until 2028. We'll work together on deorbiting it around about 2030. And Dmitry Bakunov, he was actually due to meet that Crew 11 mission team, which you just mentioned. And you may recall, of course, that the ISS was set up by Russia, the United States, Europe, and Japan. And assembly started way back in 1998, and originally it was meant to be kept going until last year, 2024. But NASA said they could and should keep it going till 2030. So after that, then they're talking about the Gateway space station, which will mm-hmm. not be in orbit around Earth, but in orbit around the Moon.
Yeah.
And it will be a stopping off point for astronauts landing on the Moon, but not the Artemis 3, because, as we mentioned earlier, Artemis 3, the first return mission to the Moon, is set for launch in 2027, but our Gateway certainly will not be up and running and assembled by then.
Yeah, interested in going to a total lunar eclipse again, September 7th to 8th.
Lunar
7th to 8th of September 2025, which is not too far away.
Oh, yeah.
It's in Asia and Western Australia when it will be in the prime positions for doing that, so that's a little bit far away for us. We will get to see bits, corners and things chunked out. So
yeah, we get to see one every couple of years here, yeah. Total lunar eclipse.
Yeah, even New Zealand will get to see it as well, so there we go. And it's not observable at all from the Americas. So there we go.
Okay. Thank you, John, for that. Our email address for any comments, questions, queries you may have is astronomy@wcfm.a. Thanks to John for his news items and for driving the sound desk. And that's all from me, Ben Abbott, for this edition of The Astronomy Show. It's music all the way now here on 103.3 Dublin City FM until 2 a.m. Up next, that's Dublin's Greatest Hits. From 10 p.m. to midnight, we have Nigel Wood. He has his ear to the globe with his world music mix. And then from midnight till 2 a.m., Dave Barry's mix of jazz, blues, and soul. And he'll be there until 2 a.m. with a program called After Hours. But please join myself and John at the same time, 7:30 p.m. next week. We'll be back with all the latest news from all corners and dimensions of the universe. Until then, take care of each other. Thank you for listening. And say goodnight, John.
Good night, John.
Good night, John.
Broadcasting on 103.2, this is Dublin City FM.